This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, a unique blend of hunting, fishing, wildlife conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle. DSC's Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Trigicon, brilliant aiming solutions. Taurus, award-winning pistols and revolvers. Mossberg, American built, American strong. Habit, our gear, your adventure.
Welcome to another campfire session. We've got, I'm going to let you guys introduce yourself. Todd, you and Brandon, both of you. I know that you're with the Eastmans because we've had a great opportunity to spend time visiting, but tell us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and where we're going. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, so. Well, Larry, thanks for having us on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. My gracious.
We've had a wonderful time these last few evenings with you guys and everybody down here in Casper at DSC Wyoming. It's just been a ton of fun. But my name's Todd Helms, and I'm the managing editor with Eastman's Hunting Journals, and I'm the host and kind of the good looks behind our Wingmen brand.
Oh, right. he's the head wingnut.
Yeah, head wingnut. That's what you get called anyway. So Wingmen, Wingmen is the wing shooting side of Eastman's.
Yes.
A lot of folks are familiar with Eastman's hunting.
Yeah, I don't think there are too many people on this planet that like the outdoors that are not familiar.
You haven't heard of it anyway.
Right.
So we decided to fire up Wingmen 5-6 years ago now.
Right.
And it was an idea that I hatched out of, I wanted to do like a waterfowl hunting magazine.
Yes.
And we decided we'd keep everything digital with it. And it's been a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to explore new areas, new arenas, and honestly tell some stories that aren't being told, like our sage-grouse project. But
Brandon, tell us a bit about yourself. Let's go back to the sage-grouse thing, because we spent some time together and got to know a little bit more about the project. I really want to get into that. Brandon, your background, you've been around a while as well, too.
Yeah, that's a kind of a unique thing about Eastman's, is that we all wear a lot of different hats, and Yes. We all have very diverse backgrounds. Most of us didn't go to college to be, you know, an editor or a business person or whatever, but we all end up doing all this stuff. Todd's an educator, a teacher by trade, and I'm a wildlife biologist by trade. And so I spent some time working for one of the game and fish departments in the country in North Dakota, and the Mule Deer Foundation. And then, so I'm very familiar with, you know, the nonprofit world too, with like DSC, and got to learn a lot more about it this weekend, which I did, which was very cool.
No kidding.
And then, yeah, so we've both been at Eastman's quite a while. I started there, I think I'm coming up on 13 years, something like that. Wow. So it's been a while.
And you'd been there for a while. I didn't realize it was quite that long.
Yeah. So no, it's been good. And my main role there is I kind of build relationships with other companies and brands and help on the, you know, ad sales side and all that. But like we said, we each get to wear a lot of different hats and get to do some fun stuff too, besides just looking at spreadsheets all
day. Thank goodness for that, right? Both coming from, particularly you, Brandon, coming from a background of some of the other organizations, and before we get into the Sagecraft thing, I really want to visit a little bit about, you mentioned something about you learned something new about DSC while you're here. Kind of explain what you're talking about there.
Yeah, one thing that kind of blew my mind is I'm pretty familiar with most of the other nonprofit groups, which are doing a lot of good work.
You know, absolutely.
So this isn't a slam on them. It's more of just a added bonus positivity towards DSC because, you know, each organization has a structure of how they split national money versus local money. Everybody knows that, right? And but DSC's percentages that stay with the chapter, which are almost 100%, I had no idea. I thought it was just similar, you know, structure right. as everybody else. And when we got down here at the event and you guys told us that, you and Bruce, I went, huh? How's that possible?
Yeah.
And yeah, I was super impressed. Super impressed.
Well, we're very proud of how our chapter system works and right now we have 13 existing chapters, but bringing Bruce on, Borowski, has been a godsend as far as I'm concerned because we've got more chapters now waiting in the road, and down the road, I guess I should say, that will coming on board. And what you're addressing is that with DSC, the chapter initially, they had whatever number of fundraisers they have, their top fundraiser, of that top fundraiser, 75% of it stays with the chapter to begin with. Then there's a 20% of that that goes to the DSC Foundation. The DSC Foundation simply serves as kind of a clearinghouse of money kind of thing, because the good thing about it is those chapters, then when they submit that money to the DSC Foundation, they tell the DSC Foundation where they want that money to go to. And so when you get right down to 95%, and the 5% just kind of covers some administrative costs to maybe help get Bruce and me a couple of places and things like that. But 95% of whatever that top, and it's just that one, their top producer, goes to, they get to keep, only 5% of it goes to DSC. And if they have more than one fundraiser, and they can maybe make, say, $50,000 on one and make $49,995 on a second one they do, only that $50,000 is where that 5% comes from. So we're here to support conservation. Of course, everybody knows that conservation, education, hunter advocacy are the three legs of the DSC thing. So, which brings us around to one of the things that the DSC Wyoming chapter is doing in terms of funding with you guys. So tell us a little bit about the sagegrass. I've seen sagegrass. I've had managed land where we had them on places in northwestern Colorado. But tell us a little bit about it, what a sagegrass is for those folks who may have never seen or heard one. And then why is this important? Why is there something being done now in sagegrass?
Well, sagegrass are, for Wyoming folks especially, sagegrass are a pretty iconic animal.
Yes.
They are. When you see one, especially in full strut, when they're this time of year, that right now in the early mornings like this, they're out dancing and mating on what are called leks. But they're the largest native grouse in North America. And you get to Europe, they have the capercaillie's bigger, but that's about the only grouse that's bigger than a sage grouse. They're very large, size of a small turkey, basically. And a real drab-colored bird at first blush, and they blend in extremely well with their environment. So much so that until they move, you very rarely see them, unless they're standing in a road someplace.
Right.
And this time of year, they're highly visible, like I said, early in the mornings, and their mating dance and ritual is so unique. They've got this big, spiky, like, looks like a turkey, but it's spikes. Right. You know, they look like a heavy metal turkey. You know what I mean? They're just cool.
That's really a great description.
They're just cool. And they got the big, bloop, 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 you know, where they have big air sacs on their chest that they puff out and they go in and out. And they're a really spectacular bird, and they are iconic across the West. And like a lot of animals that require vast landscapes, their numbers are declining in areas. Wyoming's a stronghold. You know, we were talking with Pat Ginder last night, one of the guys here at Wyoming DSC.
Right.
And he's personally seeing lots, large numbers of birds. And he wasn't the only one. Mm-hmm. The gentleman that we were speaking to that does all the weed and pest stuff out south of Casper, he said, man, we were flushing hundreds of birds last summer and fall. So that's
stories like you hear from the old timers. You know, like my grandpa is 97. And he tells me, I was raised in southwest western North Dakota, and the ranch that he grew up on, it was really close to a big chunk of BLM.
Right.
And he said they would go over there and shoot rabbits as kids. And, you know, all his generation all calls them sage hens.
Yeah.
And they're all sage hens.
Exactly.
And he said, so many sage hens would get up, it sounded like a train coming through. There'd just be tons of them. And we're starting to hear some stories of that again,
right?
In certain locations, so not across their range, but in certain locations.
Across their range, their numbers are down. You know, when we look at greater sage grouse range, you know, like habitat across the western states, overall they're down. Some areas down so much so that there's a subspecies they're calling it in Nevada, on the Nevada California border. That those birds have been. They're probably going to list those birds. It's a little small population that's isolated, and they're struggling hard. But in where sage grouse habitat is relatively undisturbed, like Wyoming and vast parts of southern Montana and Idaho, eastern Washington, Oregon, Utah, those birds are doing quite well, but they're not. Those numbers aren't where they were historically. Kind of like mule deer. They're very tied in tight with mule deer. I like what you said about the train because there's an old story that goes along with the railroad. When they were building the railroads, they were feeding the workers so many sage grouse that the workers went on strike. They stopped working and said, you can't feed us any more sage grouse. So they came up to it with a deal that they could only feed them sage grouse twice a week. Something akin to that. You know, it was like, we can't eat any more of these sage grouse. They were sick of them because sage grouse get a bad rap as being not a very good eating bird, which is not true. If they're cooked properly, they're like a lot of things. They're excellent.
It's kind of like Moses and the, you know, manna and quail in the desert. They're like, how long do we have to eat this manna and quail? Instead of sage grouse.
Yep. Sage chickens.
Yeah.
But, you know, so they have a rich, rich history. They've been on the landscape since the beginning.
Yes.
You know, and they're just, like I said, I keep using the word icon, but they really are. There's a handful of animals in the Rocky Mountain West that are iconic. You know, you think of antelope or pronghorns, think mule deer, sage grouse. Elk are kind of ubiquitous across North America.
Right.
You know, there's elk. We're expanding elk range back into stuff where they used to be in the East. But mule deer didn't live east of the Mississippi.
No.
Pronghorn antelope didn't live east of the Mississippi. No. And so.
Well, and they're kind of a. One of those barometer species too, where when over time, when you see, you know, biologists and sportsmen and others are seeing some disturbing trends, not just a little bit, but pretty massively, especially 15, 20 years ago, it's like, are you guys noticing that we're not seeing the counts on the lakes like we did? And they thought, oh, maybe it's a dip in a year. And that could be part of it. But they're kind of as Ike Eastman always calls them, they're sort of the canary in the coal mine species. Like, okay, there's something wrong.
Right.
So that's probably going to affect also pronghorn and mule deer and a little bit of elk in the winter range.
Yep.
And even some of the elk just living out in the desert. And, but at the same time, I think we're still learning, you know, most grouse species are pretty cyclical, right? They, you know, rough grouse are like to the year, 10 years, 10 years, 10 years, 10 years. And you have, and sharp-tailed grouse are a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like the perfect storm. I think there's things going on that we found through this film on the landscape that's happening that needs to be fixed. And it's being worked on, whether it's predation by ravens, it's better fencing structures and how to mark the fences so they're not hitting them when they're flying. It's feral horses. A whole bunch of different stuff, right? Cheatgrass.
Cheatgrass is a big one. That was one we kind of got into last night,
you know,
talking to some folks actually from Scotland that wanted to know how this compared to some of the management that they do with their grouse in Scotland.
Right.
We got talking about invasive grasses and cheatgrass being the biggest culprit. And I said, what it does is, I said, cheatgrass creates a fire load underneath there because it matures very quickly and then it dries out. Nothing eats it once it's mature. It's a cattle graze on it when it's young and green. Right. And some birds will eat the seed, the grass awns, but not very much. But what it does is what we're finding out through this, and this is new information to us that we learned, but biologists and state agencies have not, NGOs have been working on this for a long time, that if we can mitigate cheatgrass, we reduce the fire cycle. We break the fire cycle. And what happens is the fire cycle is at the point now where the cheatgrass catches fire from a lightning strike or somebody flicks a cigarette butt out of the car, you know, whatever, however it would happen, naturally or man-made, that burns so hot that burns off everything underneath the sagebrush and it burns up the sagebrush. Sagebrush doesn't regrow annually. It's like a miniature forest. It takes a long time for this short forest sagebrush ecosystem to grow and regrow, especially after fire. Well, cheatgrass comes right back. And so it's choking the landscape out is what it's doing. And there's herbicides out there that are wrapped up in bureaucratic red tape that it's frustrating to watch, that one agency can use, another agency can't. It's like, you know, it's those are the things that we learned on this project. Well, right down to the agenda. Well, you
could, and to elaborate too, I'm back to those cycles. Yeah. And I don't think we really understand the sage grouse population natural cycles either. And so I think we're seeing the perfect storm or some of these other challenges. Right. Plus, it might have been, I don't know for sure, but my theory is very long-term valley of the cycle. And I personally think we're seeing them climbing back out of the cycle. But again, it's not like rough grouse where it's, they're fighting an uphill battle, and they're not like rough grouse where it's going to happen in a couple of years.
Right.
It might take 50.
Right. The guys we were talking to, and when you and I went and filmed the pheasant hunt in Montana, when we went mm-hmm. hunting in Montana mm-hmm. with the guys from Onyx and Pheasants mm-hmm. Forever mm-hmm. and Federal, then they were talking about how grouse numbers in Minnesota this year, rough grouse numbers, were the highest that anybody's seen in mm-hmm. 50 years. They're like, yeah, it was ridiculous how many birds there were. But that's a short cycle.
Right.
It's up and down, up and down. I grew up with that. And you made hay when the sun went, when you could, when those cycles were great. It was great hunting. And on years when you might struggle to shoot 2-3 birds in a season. And that's that's what Brandon's talking about, that slow rebound. You know, everything in the sagebrush ecosystem seems like it rebounds really. It's a real slow roll. It's nothing is like this.
Now, when you're managing for, you know, whitetail and pheasants in the Midwest or upper Midwest, like what I used to do for the game of fish
right.
as part of my job, you could affect populations pretty fast. I mean, oh, yes. Pheasants and whitetail recover quickly most of the time.
Yes.
And it's easy to, you know, build some habitat, the animals will come, right? If you build it, they will come. And out here with these vast landscapes, plus with hardly any moisture, so it takes forever for things to recover. Again, not that fire is bad, but too much fire too often with no moisture, and the native plants aren't
coming back. Particular field that you're talking about, in a native situation of sagebrush, yeah, there's going to be a fire. But as you mentioned, when you get all this field on the ground,
yeah.
that normal fire that you might have in native situations, it's going to be very beneficial to go through it. It's not going to
right.
burn everything or burn all the seeds that are in the ground. It'll germinate some things as well. But yeah. that doesn't happen when you have those really, really hot fires.
And fires that are just too often is a problem
yes.
with that cheatgrass.
Right on top of each other, stacked up. And then the West has been in a pretty substantial drought cycle.
Yes.
For the most part. There's areas that get water every year, you know, whatever. But as a general rule, the West has been in a heck of a drought cycle. So these birds are fighting a drought cycle. They're fighting cheatgrass. They're fighting too much fires. They're fighting a massive feral horse problem, which in Nevada is...
Thank you.
It's through... Nevada's... It's bad in Wyoming. Like, I could take you out here south of town, and specifically southwest, about an hour, and we'd see a lot of horses on the landscape. And they've removed 2,000 horses in the last year. But they're, and so what we have in Wyoming is bad, and Nevada's got it way worse.
Well, the bad thing about horses, as far as I'm concerned, most grazing animals have teeth only on the bottom.
Uh-huh.
Horses have teeth on the top and the bottom. So rather than just take the nip off the top, they go all the way down and they pull everything out. So you lose the plant.
Yeah.
You're not just grazing a part of it. You're losing the entire thing.
And they don't graze and move on.
No.
Like cattle, yeah. Like, so bison, right? We had bison on the landscape. They're native, the sage grouse would have cohabitated with them. Bison have been removed. We put cattle in their place. And if we rotate cattle and manage them properly, we can use cattle like bison.
Amen.
But horses, they'll stay in one spot and just destroy a spot. And then they'll move to the next spot. And just, it's amazing when you look at these water holes, these mesic areas where the horses have been fenced out, how quickly they rebound. Right down south here on the Pathfinder Ranch, there's an area that just been decimated by poor cattle management practices a little bit and feral horses.
Right.
And then they fenced out a big spring head and did some restoration work there. It is night and day. And it was like, what, a year and a half? It looked like a different landscape.
Well, you think about it with horses, and we're not, you know, we love horses. We love
We're in Wyoming.
It's horses. It's a horse culture, right?
Absolutely.
We use them for hunting. We use them for whatever, but... Yeah. Like a guy I know back in the town we live in, he said, when have you ever driven by a pasture, whether it's feral horses or somebody's stock, where their heads weren't down eating? It's 24/7. And so if you have a bunch of feral horses out there doing that on the landscape that's pretty sensitive anyway, it's just a constant, not just a lawnmower, almost like a, I don't know, like a herbicide.
It's like a herbicide. They just essentially remove everything. Again, it's not, they're just not kind of nipping it like a cow or a deer or elk or whatever. I mean, they're going to run their tongue out, or they're going to nip at the very most nutritious part there and then move on kind of thing. The horses, you mentioned, just go there and he'll just eat things until there's nothing left.
Yeah, they've got that one digestive tract.
Yeah.
You know, they're not a ruminant. So they got to eat a ton to fuel that big body. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And we all like horses. Everybody likes horses.
Yeah.
But you look at that situation and it's kind of like, we can do better.
Yes.
You know? And so there's that. Then there's nest predation, you know, with, we have more ravens on the landscape 24/7 now, and they're hard on not just sage grouse. Mm-hmm. They're hard on all ground nesting birds.
Right.
They enter because they're nest predators. You see them, they'll be hovering along, riding the wind, which today, that's typical Wyoming wind.
Yeah,
it's blowing about 20 sustained, you know.
Maybe a little light.
Just a light breeze, you know, but they'll just hover 5-6 feet off the ground, riding those wind currents.
Yes.
And their head's down, and you see them, and that's what they're doing. They're looking for food. And again, doing what they do, that raven, there's nothing inherently bad about a raven.
No.
But when there's too many of them, and they're nesting in old abandoned structures, they're nesting in areas, you know, abandoned cattle sheds or, you know, whatever. They're so highly adaptable. Ravens thrive where humans live. Sage grouse don't. Sage grouse need a wilder, more natural landscape. Red fox, same thing, which was really interesting to see that gentleman from Scotland's reaction when I brought up red foxes, because they've lost their ability to manage foxes.
I know.
And he was like, foxes are really hard on nest, on ground nest.
Well, and that birds. Just comes back to kind of the whole big overarching topic, I think. It doesn't matter if it's ravens or horses or foxes and wolves and bears and whatever.
Yeah.
We just need to manage them. You know, that's one of the things that we're tasked with as people. Is to manage wildlife, and managing is, you know, the definition of management is managing it, like helping things do what they need to do. Whereas non-management is hands off, letting them living in this utopian mindset that things will just recover. You know, things will just, we're so far past that, you know, with the way our landscape is always changing with more and more people and all that it has to be managed. And that's the detriment. I mean, you know, Valerius Geist, when he was still alive, he would just highly criticize the United States' large predator management strategies, because basically the strategy was don't do anything. You can't shoot them. You can't control them. You can't whatever. And it's not good for those critters either.
No, it's not even good for that group of animals that who are the predators.
Right.
They'll suffer in the long run as well, too.
Yeah, exactly. And the public perception, you know, it's such a, cantankerous argument all the time with any of these topics, and they should, and it shouldn't be. It should be just like managing a deer. It should be like managing a pheasant or a grouse species. Like, everything needs to be managed together, not just, well, we're just going to manage this little piece of the puzzle and leave the rest of it go.
Yeah, it didn't work that way.
No. Yeah, and unfortunately, you're getting to, I think, what Larry wanted to touch on as well. This project, sage grouse projects, are, let's go hunt, let's go do a sage grouse hunt, that'd be cool. And then it turned into, well, I peeled back one layer and there was 40,000 layers, like an onion times 1,000, you know? We just keep peeling stuff back. We're finding all this stuff, all this research. Lindsay, our video producer, has been incredible with this because she's uncovered so much of what we've found through getting lining up interviews for this project.
Right.
And the more people we talk to, the wider it's the scope just gets huge. One of the things that we came to see pretty quickly was there's an agenda with sage grouse to use sage grouse if they can get the birds listed on the ESA, that pushes then closures of habitat, which out west where the sage grouse lives affects ranching, it affects oil development, it affects recreational use. We've got a lek out here. We've got a known population of sage grouse on this landscape. We're going to close down this massive section of ground because sage grouse will fly 15 to 20 miles from the lek to nest. And you get 50 of them out there doing that every direction. Well, you got to start closing down a lot of ground. And pretty soon there's no energy development going on. I mean, when I could rant about this, Larry, but I'm not going to. But that, it's something we uncovered, that there's an agenda out there to use the sage grouse to close down public lands.
Well, on the public land footprint that could be affected, you know, you being a Texas guy, you know how big that state is. And it's a land mass that almost equals the size of Texas out west with all the cumulative acreages. And it's like, that's mind numbing.
Yeah. That's talking about mind boggling.
Yeah.
Not to mention the economic footprint. The economic footprint is in the billions of dollars.
And you got, you know, people we interviewed oil and gas companies. We interviewed ranchers. We interviewed state and federal agencies. We interviewed folks
from the Audubon Society.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted a vast group of perspectives.
Kind of a we report, you decide type of a thing where it was, there's so many angles that have been talked about in the sage grouse story that affects so many other species and so many other ways of life. We thought, well, let's dig in. Once we started, let's dig in and just tell what's going on. We don't have to sugarcoat this one because somebody might get mad and we're going to say, this is what's happening.
Right.
So that people, the average consumer that maybe lives in Chicago and doesn't even know what a sage grouse is. I mean, there's even a lot of people in Wyoming maybe that aren't hunters or whatever that they don't know what a sage grouse is, right, and they don't care.
Or why should I care about sage grouse?
And they don't understand why that prehistoric looking bird and being listed could dramatically affect ways of life on a vast scale.
And affect them very directly without it will.
Yep.
I don't care if you live in the town, if you don't have anything to do with agriculture or whatever. You do.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And I don't want to fearmonger on this by any stretch. It's not like, oh, the big bad boogeyman is going to take all your public lands. That's not the point. The point is it's out there. That agenda exists. We need to be cognizant of that.
Yes.
And we need to be working to conserve sage grouse and sage grouse habitat. So that's not even on the table. You know, we can help these birds come. We can help these birds come back.
Right. And it's just, you know, being more intentional with that. I think people have always just taken for granted that those sage grouse are always out there. You know, that they're whatever, you know, they're not a big focal point. Well, then if you start seeing some of these disturbing trends, you're like, well, maybe we need to be a little more intentional about this bird, because what else is being affected? Like we said at the beginning, a lot.
Absolutely. Yes.
Human beings and other wildlife and.
Tell me a little bit about, you mentioned the film. Tell me about that.
So the film right now, we've got a short version that's out right now, and it's 17 minutes. And it's kind of the intro, the teaser. It's a long teaser, but the teaser to the full feature film. So our plan was to have a 30 to 60 minute just short documentary. Well, the more, as Todd alluded to, the more we dug into it. Right now,
expand,
Lindsay, our producer, who's I'm pointing over here because she's sitting right here.
I'm in the corner. Sorry.
But Lindsay, right now, has it cut down to about an hour and 45 minutes, and even now, it's like
we're barely telling the story.
How do we get that down to an hour so it can run on the Outdoor Channel and that people aren't bored to tears on YouTube watching too much, you know, data and information that it's not interesting. And so that's kind of the challenge that we have too, is that it's a very important topic, but trying to tell the story in an interesting way to make sure people are watching it the whole way through and not getting bored with it too. Cause you don't want just a stuffy documentary with fun facts that people are like, blah, 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 after 15 minutes, I don't want to listen to this. And so that's a big challenge right now in incorporating even more information that we learned on this trip into the film. So we're actually adding to it before we even get home. And but so we're hoping that the long version of the film is going to be done. We don't have a hard date, but sometime in the next few months here, it's going to be done. And then we're going to just try and put it everywhere. We're going to have public showings of it. We're going to have it on OSG on the Outdoor Channel. We're going to have it, of course, on YouTube. We're going to be sharing it with Dallas Safari Club,
right,
so that they can be sharing it, you know, and just getting, this is one of those projects, like, you know, at Eastman's with our Wingman episodes, our Eastman's Hunting TV episodes, or Beyond the Grid episodes, whatever we're doing, our podcasts, it's a business. And so we're trying to get as many eyeballs or ears on it as possible.
Right.
You know, partially for, you know, so that we can grow our footprint and keep our sponsors happy and all that stuff that we do. But this one's different. This one is, we want people to be informed members of the voting public. You have to know this story. You have to. It's too important not to.
It affects, like you said, Larry, it affects the guy in New York or Chicago that's doing his job, going back to work, the mom running kid. You know, we're staying right now in Casper, the hotel's full of hockey kids right now. I mean, so full you can't
literally
get breakfast. I mean, it's full, right?
Rolling out doors.
Yeah, and it's fun to watch these families, you know, come and go. And it affects them. And they're not even thinking about it. They're rolling through the landscape from Casper to Rock Springs and got to get home and go to work tomorrow. And they're rolling through some of the most pristine sagebrush habitat in the world.
Yes.
There's only a handful of places on the planet that this exists. And if it goes away, if it gets protection sanctioned on it, I shouldn't say protections, if it gets shut down to the point where you're looking at billions of dollars that are going to be gone out of the economy, and it's going to affect soccer moms. It's going to affect your urban dwellers. And so when you see this, where I'm going with that is, how do you get involved? How do you help?
Exactly. You support, that's where I wanted you to go.
You support organizations like Dallas Safari Club, like DSC.
Right.
You become a member. If all you got the money to do is, and you live in Wyoming, and all you can afford to do is buy a membership and maybe do some habitat work, great. Awesome. If you can, whatever level you can be involved at is beneficial.
Even if it's just being, becoming a member of groups like this so that you're in the know of the topic.
Yes,
so
becoming aware
of. When you are the soccer mom at your kids' game, you can be talking to other people about these issues so they're informed. And it's just a snowball effect. And we all benefit for doing that. So.
And so does the wildlife. And that's really what this is about. You know, it's so cool. And in that 17-minute video, I was blessed enough to be able to have my two girls in it. I since have a little boy. And they were, my oldest was 5 at the time when we shot that, maybe 6. And the other one was 4. And they're little. And we're out there watching birds on a lek and kind of doing a lek survey. And close to home, they eat it up, Larry. Mm-hmm. They're just, they love watching those birds. And if they never even get to hunt those birds, the fact that we could still go watch them matters.
Yes.
You know, because we're down to, in this area of Wyoming, they have a one-day sage grouse season. Where we are, it's about 2 weeks, but it's short. And I honestly, we don't take a lot of those birds. All the studies, all the nest surveys, the hunting is highly regulated hunting like we're doing does not affect the birds population. But there's areas where it's like the numbers are low enough where it's like there's no, we can't take any birds. So we're managing that.
Right.
And right. being able to have my kids know that that bird is on the landscape. We see them when we're antelope hunting. We see them when we're driving to go fishing someplace up in the mountains and they're dusting in the road first in the morning. You know, they get a kick out of those birds. And if we can bring one home and eat it, even better. You know, they have feathers. We had, I was fortunate enough to do a podcast and do an actual hunt with Ramsey Russell. I think you probably are familiar with Ramsey. Very highly traveled bird guy. And my little four-year-old walked over and said, and we had him over the house for dinner. And she said, Mr. Ramsey, I'd like to give you this, but you have to guess what it is first. And she handed him a feather. And it was a rump feather off the back, the underside of the rump. And they're right. black, kind of long. Mm-hmm. Oval shaped, and they have white tips. And he could not place that feather. And that's no knock on Mr. Ramsey. It's not something he was familiar with. And so then my 4 and 6 year olds are explaining to him about the sage grouse, you know, and telling him and Mr. Ramsey, the northern Cheyenne used to build headdresses out of the feathers from the sage grouse, and the dog soldiers had a headdress that they wore. It's like a bonnet. And it's all these feathers. And when they would dance, those feathers would jiggle. And those dances were inspired by the sage grouse on the Lex. And he's eating it up because he's that guy. You know, he likes right. that history stuff. And here's my little kids. Because I've plunged them into this. Because it's so important that we know that. We know the history. We preserve those birds because they've been on the landscape longer than we have. You know, in North America. I'm not Native American.
I'm not Native American.
Well, how can somebody get involved with this, and how can they learn more about the project that you guys are doing right now?
The quickest way to learn more about the project itself is to go onto Eastman Hunting Journal's YouTube channel. That's where the video is housed right now, solely. And then, again, it's going to get put on the Outdoor Channel. It's going to be shared with a lot of our other partners who are sponsors of this. But the real call to action, I think, for the average Joe Blow going to work every day and just feeding family and all that is, and I know we've been hitting Dallas Safari Club, you know, plug pretty hard during this, but there's a reason for it. We're partners with DSC and also TRCP, which is a Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, both phenomenal groups. And become members of those groups. They're big on hunter advocacy. They're big on partnerships like this. And if you can become a member, if you can attend a fundraiser, if you can donate, if you can spread the word, then those groups that, as we learned, get to keep most of their money locally, well, have local decision where the money goes. Yeah. It doesn't have to stay locally. They have the decision-making power. But and then cumulatively, when you join those groups, then Dallas Fire Club or TRCP or name the conservation group, they have a membership base with a lot of power behind it, so they can go to Washington, D.C. and affect policy for a good thing for wildlife. And so that's, in my mind, the biggest call to action is hunt, fish, and trap, do that, and become a member of these groups. And because if you do that, you are, as I tell my kids, I've got 4 kids and my oldest is our only boy and he loves hunting just like I do. And my girls, they hunt because I make them. They like being outside and stuff, but they're not killers. You know, it's not their instinct, but they do it. And I've told all my kids, I'm like, even if you don't like hunting, you're going to do it as long as you live in this house, because I want you to be an informed member of the voting public. Because then, even if you don't hunt when you're an adult on your own, when something comes up on an initiated measure on a ballot, you're going to go, well, that's not right. I know what that issue is. No, or yes, whatever it is.
Right.
And being able to affect change that way and just getting involved. And so I think that's one of the, you know, we have such a cool model of wildlife management, the North American model of wildlife management, like we've heard the term so much lately. And we don't do a good job telling people about it. We are the envy of the globe.
And it's being it's coming under attack.
Yeah,
we're seeing the North American model of wildlife conservation being stripped away, stripped down, and removed from states like Washington, and they're doing it at the ballot box. And it's the idea is to take hunting out of the equation and the utopian mindset that these animals can be fine. And it's like, no, it's not the way this is going to work. The North American model of wildlife conservation has been proven successful for 100 years, over 100 years now, brought multiple populations of species back from the brink of nothingness. And strip that down, take that away, and a large part of them, the North American heritage, the United States heritage, and the great blessing of the wildlife that we own as people and citizens of the United States is gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a call to action. That's what
it is. A call to action. It's big action that needs to be taken.
Yes, sir.
And immediately too. Yeah. And that's the, I think the overall thing right there is become involved, become knowledgeable. And if you got money to spend, it conservation costs. But learn about wildlife, learn about habitat, and what you guys are doing through Eastman's and with this Sage-Grouse initiative is absolutely fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's fun.
I was aware of it, but I really wasn't aware of it as much as I have become, and I really appreciate that. Tell us how somebody can find out a little bit more. You mentioned the YouTube channel and all that. How do they go to a website or YouTube?
Yep, it's pretty easy. Eastmans.com. It's Eastmans.com, Eastmans.com. And we have more information and content and things to read and listen and watch that you could lose yourself the rest of your life and never take it all in. So
I think we have 5 podcasts now. Maybe 5 or 6. I can't even keep track. I host a podcast with the Wingmen Side.
Right.
We do YouTube channels. There's a weekly television series on the Outdoor Channel.
Right.
That we do.
Two magazines. Live events. I mean, it's mind-numbing, really. It's pretty cool. And the good thing is, you know, a lot of people, like you said, if you're in the outdoors, you know, the Eastman brand, you know, Eastman's Hunting Journal, Eastman's
absolutely. MD.
But one thing that people don't know is how passionate the Eastmans get about being informed, about loving the resources. And they know that we have a tremendous opportunity and responsibility as a media company in the outdoor space to tell the story and not just shoot a documentary, but we have the footprint to get it out there to a lot of people, to really millions. We touch millions of eyeballs every week in our office. And that's a pretty big responsibility when you think about it. In fact, just a real quick funny story. The first time I ever hunted for our TV show, I grew up watching the Eastmans. So, and then I work on the sales side. And so my job is to know how many eyeballs are watching the show right now and how many readers we have and all that stuff. And so I grew up watching it, grew up reading it, and then now I'm in front of the camera. In fact, I was on an antelope hunt just west of Casper, Wyoming, here where we're sitting, about 20 miles away. And I talking to the camera guy who I just met. He was a contracted camera guy that wasn't in our office. Just met at Taco Bell in town, and we were going out antelope hunting. And I'm, you know, talking about hunting, and he can tell I'm passionate about it. And as soon as he turned that camera on, I went, and I got so nervous and was really talking smooth and short of breath, and he hits the record button off and he goes, "Dude, we edit, you gotta relax." But the point was, I knew how many people were watching this show.
Exactly.
And I'm like, don't screw up, don't say something stupid. But yeah, it was pretty funny. See how far that it's come. But
well, it's been interesting because I knew Gordon.
Yeah.
He was kind of the patriarch. He used to come to South Texas, and I got to know him well down there years ago. And, of course, got to know Mike because of that. And then his sons as well, too. To watch that develop over the years has been just phenomenal. And it started with him and that passion that he had for wildlife and letting people know about it kind of thing.
Yep. Yeah, we've got a replica, not a model, but the actual camera that he used to tote around. You see in those famous pictures of him, that big wooden tripod and that Bolex camera.
Yes.
And we weighed it one day just because we were curious. So 90 days in the Northwest Territories, he's toting this thing around. 90 days. And it's something like 88 pounds or something.
Oh,
like
yes.
That. And we complain when our jet boils 2 ounces too heavy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, I'm not wearing that pair of boots are too heavy, you know. I mean, we are not tough compared to those.
Oh, guys. My gosh. And there's Larry, there's Gordon stories, and we could sit here for days and tell
I know. And we'll do that on another time.
It would be fun.
It really would be. I'd like to get Dyke and maybe even Mike and you
there
guys
you go.
And just kind of say, okay, let's talk about some of the past type of things.
That would be fun.
But the overarching thing about the love of wildlife is kind of what Eastman's is really about.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's what we do. You know, you'll see Mike. He's retired.
Right.
And you'll see him out in his vehicle photographing mule deer on the winter range in 20 below. And he's just out there sitting there north of town, just hanging out, watching deer. A few elk up there. Not everybody does that. You know, people just drive by. They don't even see those. And he's out there watching. And he instilled that. Gordon instilled that in him. And he instilled that in his sons. And it's just.
And he's instilling it upon those folks who are associated with him.
And that's the goal.
Which I can see in you guys dearly love.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah, feels the fire for sure.
Feel the fire.
Yeah.
It's a good way to end this. We need to feel the fire, guys. So I want to thank you so much, Todd and Brandon, for being with me here today on DSC's Campfires. And I look forward to another opportunity, and we'll make that happen. So thank you all very much. Thank you so much for what you're doing with the Sagegrass Initiative as well, too. And learn more about anybody that's listening to this. Learn more about that. And again, go to eastmans.com is a good place to start. And then you can go to all kinds of other things that they do there. But again, thank you guys so very much for being with us here around the campfire. And as I said, look forward to the next opportunity.
Well, we thank you, for having us. I mean, if you would have told me, you know, 10 years ago, I'd be sitting in Larry Wysoon's hotel room recording a podcast with him. I'd be like, you got to be kidding.
Yep.
Because, you know.
Not going to happen. No. You know, my dad's so jealous right now. He's a Larry Wysoon fanboy, man. I'm telling you.
I'm truly honored. So maybe we can all kind of get around a campfire here before too very long.
There you go.
Sounds good.
And thank you for all that you do for DSC and wildlife as well. And having us on, this has been great.
You're very kind. We're all in this together.
DSC's Campfires has also been brought to you by the Crown Bar in La Grange in Round Top, Texas, Texas Wildlife Association, Double Nickel Taxidermy, H3 Whitetail Solutions, and Burnham Brothers Game Calls.